Eagles wide receiver Riley Cooper's videotape racial slur this summer prompted plenty of conversation about race, but to what end? Tomorrow evening, the conversation continues with the kickoff to this semester's Lightbulb Cafe Penn Series. John Jackson, professor of communication, Africana studies, and anthropology at Penn's Annenberg School, will discuss practicing impolite conversations, talking about race, religion, politics, and everything else. Well, let's start that practice right now. Professor Jackson, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, David.
Why in 2013 are we still at the practice stage of talking about these topics?
I think one of the reasons why we're still at the practice stage is because the nature of the kinds of conversations we have to have continue to change. And so one of the problems is we often use antiquated and old models for contemporary and emergent conditions. And that's our issue. So it isn't like, well, we did this before, why do we have to do it again? The nature of the kinds of interactions we're having in the 21st century are just qualitatively different from the ones before. So we have to relearn as we go. And that's part of, I think, what makes these discussions so difficult, because we want to believe that we've already figured that out, that we already know how to deal with particular problems, not recognizing that the problems evolve and change and grow as we do.
You're the author of Racial Paranoia, The Unintended Consequences of Political Correctness. And you state in the book that in some sense, when racism was more overt, say in the 1960s, it was easier, obviously, to talk about. And now with political correctness, one has to hide one's feelings, and it becomes very dicey to even discuss race.
Well, I think part of what we've done effectively is we won the moral argument, and that's a huge coup, right? So for the history of the republic, the vast majority of the years of this republic, it was perfectly reasonable for people to walk around and say horrible things about folks of different racial, ethnic, or sexual, religious beliefs. And in some ways, that was par for the course. And one of the things the 20th century wrought was this understanding that that isn't the way to cultivate a real multicultural society. And they have to be respectful of others. So all of that makes sense. I think there's just a flip side to that, that is the difference between what people mean when they say sort of colorblind and they're talking about transcending difference versus the colorblind that's really just repressing the stuff that's already there that hasn't gone away but that we know we can't talk about. And I think the book really is about that distinction. It's about saying, you know, it's not enough simply to clean up public discourse if we haven't cleaned up the kinds of assumptions and presuppositions that animated that discourse previously.
Does it start with acknowledging racism that exists to varying degrees in each of us? In an Inquirer editorial in response to that Cooper case, you stated that we don't have the luxury of throwing people, quote, off the island. Even if we could, there'd soon be nobody left to banish. And that seems to imply that we're all racist to varying degrees.
I mean, we're all raised in a society that is steeped in assumptions about the power of race to tell us who people are. So all race is really supposed to be, like other forms of identity identification, is a kind of shorthand. And so even when we imagine, you know, well, my family in particular wasn't racist, or, you know, I really don't feel like I'm invested in racialism, what that doesn't get at is the fact that you're still a part of a larger cultural landscape where other people are thinking about that, and it is informing their actions, their perspectives. And so you still have to negotiate it, and there's no way you can completely cut yourself off from a lot of its perspectives and implications. And so the key is to say, you know, it's almost like he who's without sin should cast the first stone. We all, in the sort of dark recesses of our souls, can sometimes think some very horrible things, even if we quickly dismiss it out of hand afterwards. But the idea is to say, well, what would really happen if we were honest about the difference between some of the stuff we imagine we say in public and the things we might still harbor in our heart of hearts?
But then once you take that test, how do you put training wheels on it? How do you practice impolite conversations with others?
Well, one of the first orders of business I want to argue is you can't have substantive, really forward-thinking conversation with absolute strangers. So that's one of the problems, I think, with a lot of the discourse about having conversations on race, is what we want to do is we want to speak to strangers who we don't know. And so as soon as they say something we don't like or we find offensive, which will probably be the case more likely than not, it will, we just write them off because we don't have an investment. So the first thing we need to figure out is, are there ways we can forge more substantial relationships across lines of difference? right? Not just superficial ones. And if we look at our social networks, a lot of us have very monolithic social networks. Our closest friends, family members often aren't as diverse as they could be. And I think the key is to start with a series of really important discussions with yourself about the ways in which you almost effortlessly can reproduce sort of social distance and social homogenization in your own social networks. And after you do that, then I think the key is to recognize that no matter what you think, no matter what you believe, no matter how careful you are in these conversations, you're going to say something stupid or something that's going to come off maybe in a way you didn't intend. But the key is, I think, to stay in that discussion and try to listen even more than you're trying to make your point.
And paradoxically, you posit it's perhaps more effective having conversations directly with, say, a Riley Cooper or a Michael Richards, what have you, somebody who's already come out and made a statement and isn't hiding behind other falsehoods.
I mean, I think one of the ironies in all of those instances, Michael Richards and the Cooper case, is the people who know him best, who know these folks best. So for Michael Richards or other black comics, even the black comics who talk a lot about race and racism in America, who often came to their defense. And the only reason why they could do that was because they had real relationships with these folks. So they could imagine that, you know, Michael Richards, all the comments he made about lynching and the N-word in his stand-up comedy when he had that meltdown, that that for them was an aberration. And if they didn't have those relationships, all it would be another gotcha moment that meant we're going to write this person off and not deal with him again because all he ever is and will be for all time is a capital R racist. Like, that's the other part of this that becomes really difficult, I think, to get people to recognize, that there aren't racists over here in this corner and then non-racists over there. Racism becomes this thing, this idea, this sensibility that can almost bubble up without us thinking about it, without realizing that it was in us to begin with. And I think that's the part of it that's even more interesting and nuanced. That it's not like, you know, Michael Richards is racist because he said that, and if he had never said that, he wouldn't have been racist. The idea is, well, what are the ways in which we're all susceptible to racism's charms? In what moments, in what context does it come together in a way that allows us to express it in ways that other people might find disturbing and offensive?
You wear several hats, professor, urban ethnographer, anthropologist. What's your assessment over time? How have you seen the conversation evolve, if at all?
One of the things I've been most interested in are the examples of people, communities that push the conversation in unexpected and unanticipated ways. And so for me, one of the ways in which this is evolving really quickly is that it's no longer isolated to sort of face-to-face localized communities. Because of new media technology, because of globalization, we're hearing stories, right? Racist stories, sexist stories from halfway around the globe, and using those as bits of evidence in our discussions back home with our colleagues, with our friends, with our family. And so just recognizing the extent to which we have access to all of these varied examples of things we might imagine to be untoward or disturbing and creepy, and the ease with which we can fold those into our everyday vernacular conversations. There's a book I'm just finishing that's coming out next month called Thin Description. And part of the point of the book, it's about a group of African Americans that left Chicago in 1967, first for West Africa and then eventually for Southern Israel, where they've been now for over 40 years. And part of what the book is trying to argue is there's a twofold argument. One is that all the ways we describe ourselves are thin. Right? There's something about being a human being that always outstrips the labels and categories we try to apply to us and use to make distinctions between and among members of our species. But also that people are constantly making decisions that are about them attempting to find a way to forge a better life for themselves. So for these African Americans in Chicago in the 60s, it meant it was time to leave. Everyone else was digging in their heels about to be a civil rights and black power moment. They decided they were going to head off. But they were heading off because they thought they could find an opportunity abroad to create a new version of social and spiritual and racial community. And so for me, it's always looking for folks who are getting us to think differently because they have found these kind of unprecedented and almost in some ways uncanny ways of trying to reimagine what's possible for them and for the people that they love. And so I'm constantly looking at those moments as illuminating ones because they can help us to figure out some of what we take for granted that we maybe shouldn't be taking for granted quite as much in the future.
Sounds like thin Description is a form of history, history being, of course, his story, which ultimately is just point of view. Interesting how you cite new media technology as a way to facilitate this trend.
Well, the reason why in some ways it's always, for me, front and center is because there's no way to think about cultural practices in the contemporary moment without recognizing the extent to which a lot of our access to it is mass mediated. So I'm trained in a discipline where you did your research, at least in the early parts of the 20th century, by almost pretending the modern world away. You went to a primitive, quote unquote, village somewhere, you hunkered down with a pit helmet, and you did your research. And it was almost like the rest of the global landscape was a distraction. It kept you away from the pure, pristine, historical community that you were trying to study. The group I'm looking at, for instance, now in southern Israel, you know, they have a 5-continent-wide spiritual community that would be impossible for them to maintain without Facebook and Twitter and all the other things that we take for granted as ways of entertaining ourselves and getting information, but is also techniques we use to forge differently configured communities across space. And so for me, it's, as an anthropologist, you almost have to recalibrate your brain, because we used to think our job was to pretend those things away. But if you're studying culture, you're studying cultural groups and communities, there's no way to think about them at all without imagining these media technologies as being constitutive of what determines their boundaries and helps them to forge the relationships with one another.
What do you hope to impart to attendees Tuesday night at this conversation about talking about race, religion, politics, and everything else?
I mean, I think I want people to feel like we can be courageous a little bit tomorrow, that we can try to take on these issues in ways that'll feel safe and that'll maybe give us something to hold on to bring back to our places of work the next day, or bring back to school, or even bring back home to talk to spouses and children about. Small things, right? Nothing big. It's not necessarily going to be paradigm shifting, but I think every small, tiny bit helps. And if we're thinking of ways of building a community that's going to work for the 21st century, it means we're going to have to take small steps and make sure that we're all doing things every single day to try to move ourselves in the right direction.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Professor John Jackson, professor of communication, Africana studies, and anthropology at Penn's Annenberg School, also the author of Racial Paranoia, The Unintended Consequences of Political Correctness. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at Penn's Lightbulb Cafe series at World Cafe.